welcome to episode 2 of the Crime Time podcast. I hope you enjoyed the first episode on the Beast of Berkenshaw. If you're new to the podcast, be sure to check that first episode out. This episode is going to explore a case so twisted and unbelievable that it could easily be mistaken as a work of fiction. However, the horror of Alcala happened, and today we'll be going down the rabbit hole and investigating the dark case of Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer. Alcala was born on August 23rd, 1943, in San Antonio, Texas. At the age of 8 years old, the Alcala family moved to Mexico. Shortly after moving, Alcala's father abandoned the entire family, which resulted in Rodney, his siblings and mother moving back to America and settling in Los Angeles. Throughout his youth, Alcala was a fairly normal person, no real signs of violence or aggression. He left school and enrolled in the army at the age of 17. However, his spell in the army did not last long, and in 1964, he was medically discharged after suffering a mental breakdown and later being diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. Alcala was an intelligent man with reports of an IQ of 135, and upon leaving the army, he enrolled in a fine arts degree at UCLA, graduating with his degree in 1968. This was also the year that the horror of Alcala began to unfold. Tally Shapiro, 8 years old at the time, was walking to school, and by all accounts, it was just a normal day. Her world, however, was about to be changed forever. As she walked to school, a car pulls up next to her. The man behind the wheel rolls down the window and calls her over. The man is young, with long curly hair and a friendly face. Tally hesitates, as she has been taught to be cautious of strangers. Alcala seeks to reassure her, saying, "Don't you recognise me?" and that he is a friend of her parents, and wants to show her a picture and give her a lift to school. He claims this photograph is amazing and that she will absolutely love it. Alcala displays a big smile and appears by all means to be telling the truth. So Tally gets into the car with Rodney Alcala. While this scene unfolds, Donald Haynes is stuck in traffic when something peculiar catches his eye. A car slowly following a young girl down the street. Donald can tell straight away that something is not right. The young girl eventually gets into the car, and something in Donald's gut tells him that the young girl's in trouble, and he proceeds to follow the car. Alcala drives towards his apartment with Tally in the passenger seat. Alcala seeks to reassure her, saying that the photo is in his apartment and he needs to quickly go get it, and then he will show it to her and take her to school. They arrive at his apartment complex and he tells Tally to come up to the apartment with him and he will show her the photo. Meanwhile, Donald Haynes has successfully followed Alcala and is watching Alcala take the girl up to his apartment. He proceeds to call the police. LAPD officer Chris Camacho arrives in the scene, following the 911 call from Donald Haynes. Donald points to a door on the first floor of the apartment complex and tells the officer that that is where the man took the young girl. Camacho calls for backup and approaches the door. He knocks and shouts that he is a police officer, and a few seconds go past with no answer, when suddenly the blinds move and a man appears at the window. He tells the officer that he has just got out of the shower and he needs to get dressed before he can open the door. Camacho notices that the man's hair was not wet and the whole scene appears to be off. He shouts again through the door, telling the man to open the door or he'll break it down. After no response, Officer Camacho kicks the door open. However, the man had escaped through a back door. The apartment was full of camera equipment and photos of young girls. Officer Camacho, however, notices a trail of blood and follows this. The blood leads to a lifeless young girl on the floor. The blood leads to Tali Shapiro. The officer notices that the girl has had a heavy metal bar placed across her throat to suffocate her and has been beaten very badly with multiple wounds to her head. Camacho carefully removes the bar from the girl's throat so not to disturb any evidence. At this point, backup has arrived and has begun to search the apartment. Officer Camacho, believing the girl to be dead, joins his colleagues and searches the apartment for information as to who the killer was. All of a sudden, he hears a noise, a choking sound, and he is astonished when he realises that the girl is still alive. He calls for an ambulance and stays by her side until it gets there. It was later noted that Tali had been hit over the head with the bar and subjected to a horrific rape, following which Alcala tried to strangle her with the bar when Officer Camacho had interrupted him by knocking on the door. Officers continue to search the apartment and they find a student ID from UCLA. The ID belongs to Rodney Alcala. Detective Hodell was appointed to investigate the Tali Shapiro case. He started interviewing friends and professors of Alcala at UCLA, and they were shocked to learn what he had done. Alcala had, by all accounts, been living a normal life, and one professor even said that Rodney would not hurt a fly. In the fall of 1968, John Berger applies to NYU School of Fine Arts. Rodney Alcala had taken on this identity in a bid to start a new life and escape the prison cell that was waiting for him back in Los Angeles. Even though Alcala was listed on the FBI's most wanted list, Alcala was able to attend NYU from 1968 to 1971 and went completely undetected. Spending his spare time taking photos of girls all around New York and going to student nightclubs. It seemed that Alcala had got away with the rape and attempted murder of Tali Shapiro and that John Berger would be able to live out his life in New York City. In the summer, Alcala worked at an all-girls summer camp in New Hampshire. Amazingly, the camp organisers did not do a background check on him, so he was able to charm his way into getting the job. During his spell working at the camp in 1971, Alcala's dark past caught up with him. Two girls attending the camp took a stroll into town and ended up in a post office when something caught one of the girls' eye. It was the FBI's most wanted list, and to their horror, one of the men in the list was very familiar to them. It was their camp teacher, John Berger. But the most wanted list had his real name, Rodney Alcala. The girls hurried back from the post office. They struggled to believe that the friendly John Berger could really be the monster they had read about on the most wanted poster. They informed the camp leader of what they had found, and while the leader remained sceptical, he decided to call the police. When the police arrived, they went to John Berger's cabin, and he is taken from the cabin in handcuffs to the police car. Rodney Alcala has been arrested for the attempted murder and rape of Tali Shapiro. He is returned to Los Angeles to face his charges. When Alcala arrives in LA, he is met by Detective Hodell. Hodell knows he has finally caught the man he's been chasing for the past 3 years. Alcala faced trial in August 1971 for the attempted murder and rape of Tali Shapiro. However, the prosecutors faced a major flaw. The Shapiro family had decided to move to Mexico, and Tali's parents refused to let her testify. The prosecution, fearing they would not get a conviction without the testimony of Tali, offered Alcala a deal. They would drop the charges of attempted murder and rape if he pled guilty to the lesser charge of child molestation. For this plea deal, Alcala was sentenced to 1 year to life. This effectively meant he would be behind bars until he could demonstrate that he was reformed. He did not spend long in prison. Alcala was a master manipulator and was able to use his charm to convince the parole board that he was reformed, and after only 34 months, Alcala was back on the streets. 8 weeks after release, Alcala had committed a breach of his parole conditions. He was noticed by a park ranger when the ranger spotted Alcala and a 13-year-old girl going up to a hillside in a park. The girl appeared very uncomfortable, and therefore the ranger approached them. Alcala had gave the girl marijuana and took her to the park after promising to take her to school. This showed incredible similarities to the kidnapping of Tally. For this, he had breached his parole conditions and was returned to prison. Again, however, he used his charm to convince the parole board that he was reformed. And Alcala was back out on the streets in less than 2 years. In 1977, Alcala was released from prison after yet again using his charm to convince the parole board that he was reformed. At this time, he remained in Los Angeles and did not return to New York. Alcala was also able to get a job at the Los Angeles Times as a typesetter, with the aim of working up to being a photographer for the Times. He did not face a background check for this job, and much like getting the job at the summer camp in New Hampshire, he slipped through the net and was able to get the job. In November 1977, Alcala began a spiral of violence that escalated in brutality and speed. His first victim was Jill Barcombe. Jill was originally from New York and had recently moved to Los Angeles. Alcala lured her to a secluded spot under the promise that he would be taking her photograph and help her publish it in the local media. Alcala proceeded to violently rape her and followed up this horrific crime by bashing her head with a large rock. This, however, did not kill Jill, so Alcala tied a belt around her neck and strangled her to death. Alcala abandoned the body of Jill Barcombe in the Hollywood foothills. He had posed her in a horrific position and left her to be found by the authorities. Alcala had developed a taste for killing and using his charm and influence over women. He started to ramp up his crimes following the murder of Jill Barcombe. Between 1977 and 1979, he murdered the following women: Georgia Wickstead, Pamela Jean Lamson, Christine Ruth Thornton, Joyce Gaunt, Charlotte Lamb, and Jill Parentu. All women were allured by Alcala and fell for his charms. All were tragically, and in some cases, brutally killed. Rodney Alcala had officially become a serial killer. On the 13th of September, 1978, an episode of the popular show The Dating Game aired. This episode appeared like all the others that came before it, with lots of flirting and innuendo between the bachelors and the bachelorette. This episode, however, will go down in history. Host Jim Lang introduces Bachelor Number 1, who is described as a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. This was met with laughter from the crowd. The host then reveals the name of the contestant: Rodney Alcala. During the show, Alcala and the bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw really hit it off. Alcala is confident, charismatic, and determined. The pair flirts throughout the show. Cheryl at one point asks him, "I am serving you at dinner. What do you look like?" He responds after a few moments, "I'm called the banana. and I look really good. Peel me. At the end of the game, Cheryl Bradshaw is given the choice of which of the three bachelors does she want to go on a date with. She builds the suspense a little, but it is clear to all watching who she will pick. She chooses Bachelor number 1, Rodney Alcala. Following her choice, the screen is lowered and the pair see each other for the first time. Rodney confidently embraces her and takes her hand. They then go backstage. Cheryl immediately begins to get an uneasy feeling about him, describing him as creepy and too intense. She gets the attention of one of the show's producers and makes up an excuse of feeling unwell just so she can get away from him. It will never be known if by doing this, Cheryl has just saved her own life. In an interview a few years later, another contestant on the show claimed that Alcala walked up to him before the show started and got right into his face, sternly telling him, "I always get the girl." This provides a glimpse into the mentality of Rodney Alcala. It is claimed that he was furious at being rejected and that this led him to increase his murderous spree. It was also in 1978 that Alcala began to appear more on police radar. He was interviewed in 1978 as a possible suspect in the Hillside Strangler case. However, he was quickly ruled out. His murder spree continued in 1978 and 1979 when he murdered Charlotte Lamb, Jill Parentu, and Robin Samso. The murder of Samso would prove to be the beginning of the end for Alcala. Robin Samso was a 12-year-old girl who lived in Huntington Beach, California. On June 20th, 1979, she was on her way to a ballet class when she was abducted by Alcala. 2 weeks after being abducted, the horrifically mutilated body of the young girl was found by police in the Angeles National Forest. Her head had been cut off along with her hands. She'd been knocked unconscious so hard that it had cracked her front teeth. This was by far Alcala's most brutal attack and demonstrated a killer growing in confidence. He had also at this time started to collect prizes from his victims, and in Robin's case, he had taken her earrings. Following the discovery of Robin's body, detectives interviewed her friends, and they confirmed to the detectives that prior to her going missing, they had been at the beach when a strange man had approached them. He had asked if he could take photos of them, and when the girls refused, the man left. But clearly, he did not forget. The friends helped a sketch artist produce a workup of what the man looked like. This was circulated around the town and the local area, and when Alcala's parole officer seen the sketch, he recognised him and alerted the police. Police obtained a warrant and searched Alcala's mother's house, where he had been staying at the time. They found a receipt for a storage locker in Seattle. The police raced to Seattle and got access into the storage locker. There they found boxes of photos of young women and girls, and boxes of trophies. In particular, they found the earrings of Robin Samso. Alcala was arrested for this, for the murder and kidnapping of Robin Samso. The trial for the murder of Robin Samso was fairly short. Alcala was as confident and charismatic as ever, with Robin's family members reporting that Alcala was blowing kisses at them, taunting them throughout the trial. In the trial, the earrings were the main piece of evidence for the prosecution. They had originally belonged to Robin's mother, and she was able to positively identify them. The jury did not take long to reach a verdict. They found him guilty for the murder of Robin Samso, and he was sentenced to death. However, the story does not end there. Alcala appeals the conviction, claiming that the jury had been biased against him, based on his past crimes. The courts agree with his appeal, and a new trial is ordered to take place. Alcala was plaguing the system and delaying his execution as much as possible. The second trial wouldn't take place until 1986. The second trial was based on the same evidence as the first, with the only exception being his criminal record was not brought up. Again, the court and jury swiftly reached the verdict of guilty, and the sentence was yet again death. Alcala appeals once more, this time to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who again agree with the appeal based on one of the defence witnesses not being allowed to support the defence's accusation that the park ranger who found the body of Robin held a strong belief that Alcala was responsible and did not consider the evidence. Due to the appeal being successful yet again, a third trial was ordered. A new technology developed between Alcala's second and third trial would prove to be a massive boost to the prosecution's case. This technology was the analysis of DNA. The year was now 2003, and Alcala had still escaped justice for the murder of Robin Samso in 1979. While preparing for the case, the prosecution learned that Alcala's DNA matched the DNA identified at the scene of the murder and rape of four women, these being 18-year-old Jill Barcombe, 27-year-old Georgia Wickstead, 31-year-old Charlotte Lamb, and 21-year-old Jill Parentu. To further support their case, the prosecution found that a pair of earrings in Alcala's storage locker had Charlotte Lamb's DNA on them. The prosecution entered a motion to have Alcala tried for all five murders at the same trial. In 2006, the California Supreme Court ruled in favour of the prosecution, despite opposition from Alcala's defence team. Alcala was ordered to stand trial for the murder and rape of Jill Barcombe, Georgia Wickstead, Charlotte Lamb, Jill Parentu, and Robin Samso. The trial was set for February 2010. For the trial, Alcala made the bizarre decision to not have a professional represent him in court, and instead, he would defend himself. It was a bizarre spectacle watching him conduct his defence. He would, for over 5 hours, conduct his defence, often referring to himself in the third person and asking questions to Mr. Alcala before pausing and then answering his own questions. He also tried to use footage from his appearance on the dating game, trying to show that the earrings that belonged to Robin Samso actually belonged to him, and that he had worn earrings in the appearance on the show. The tape, however, was very grainy and unclear, and for most of the clip, his long curly hair had covered his ears. He also claimed in his cross-examination of himself that he could not possibly have been the one who kidnapped Samso, as he had been at Knott's Berry Farm applying for a job. He made very little attempt to defend against the charges brought against him for the four other women, almost focusing his entire defence case on the Robin Samso murders, in particular focusing on the evidence of the earrings. He asked members of Robin's family to look closely at the earrings and seemed to take pleasure ordering them about, telling them to go to the stand, then to go look at the earrings, and finally dismissing them from the stand. It all appeared a show and a game to him. The only defence expert witness Alcala called was psychiatrist Richard Rappaport, who claimed that Alcala's earlier diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder could explain why Alcala has no recollection of committing the murders. The prosecution, however, quickly took control and clearly displayed their evidence, showing the DNA evidence that connected Alcala to the murder and rape of all five women, describing Alcala as being a sexual predator who knew what he was doing was wrong, but did not care. The case was clear, and for the third time, Alcala was found guilty of the murder of Robin Samso. In addition, he was also found guilty for the murder of the other four women. He was again sentenced to death. Up to this point, Alcala's dark past had not fully caught up to him. In 1971, he murdered Cornelia Crilly, and in 1977, he also murdered Ellen Hover, both while he was in New York as John Berger. The same advances in DNA collection would link these murders to Alcala, and in January 2011, he was charged with the murder of the two women. In June 2012, he pled not guilty after being extradited to New York. He, however, changed this plea to guilty in December 2012, stating that he wanted to return to California to continue fighting his death sentence. For these two additional murders, he was sentenced to 25 years to life. The death penalty was not an option in New York. Alcala, to this day, continues to work in his appeal against the death penalty. His victims and their families are still awaiting justice against a truly evil man. He's been linked to several other murders, however, the evidence is not yet strong enough for further convictions. It is reported that the number of victims could be as high as 130. He will go down in history as one of the worst serial killers, and a phantom whose actions continue to cause grief and heartbreak for the victim's family. I hope you enjoyed the insight into this dark case and the second ever episode of this podcast. Please subscribe and review where you can to support the podcast. Your support is truly appreciated, and I hope to grow the podcast and to keep improving it for all of you. Please follow the podcast on Twitter at CrimeTimeCast, where you can message me and keep up to date about future episodes. I want to finish this episode by passing my condolences and thoughts onto the families of Alcala's victims. His actions will have changed their lives, and my deepest sympathies go out to them. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay tuned for future episodes of the Crime Time Podcast.